Africa. I'm James Batty, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. Since the United States named China a currency manipulator on Monday, tensions between the two countries remain high. Still, AP's Charles de Ledesma reports that China is putting the brakes on a currency slide.
China has stabilized the yuan, suggesting it might hold off from aggressively letting the currency weaken as a way to respond to American tariffs in a trade war that is wounding the world economy. An upward-moving yuan comes a day after Beijing sent financial markets tumbling by allowing the currency to fall to an 11-year low. A weaker yuan can help neutralize American tariffs on Chinese goods by making them more price competitive on international markets. But relations remain tense between the U.S. and China over complaints that China does not trade fairly. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The currency war caused a 3% drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average Monday, its biggest drop of the year, after China let its yuan sink to its lowest point in more than a decade. On Tuesday, U.S. stocks rebounded, and the Dow climbed more than 1%. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan is vowing to reach out to the United Nations Security Council after rival India revoked the special status of the disputed Kashmir region. Prime Minister Khan told an emergency session of the Pakistani parliament the Indian action would intensify the ongoing insurgency in the majority Muslim Kashmir, and the tensions could trigger another war between the nuclear-armed nations. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's political party has long campaigned for ending the special status granted to Kashmir, saying it hampered development and encouraged young people to join insurgents fighting Indian rule. For the latest news on the go, please download the VOA mobile app. From Washington, this is VOA News. President Trump will visit the sites of last weekend's two mass shootings today. His visit comes as police in Dayton, Ohio, continue to search for a motive behind Sunday's mass shooting that left 9 people dead. The FBI is looking into whether gunman Connor Betts was influenced by violent ideologies. Bellbrook Police Chief Doug Doherty says the shooter's family is cooperating.
The Betts family is cooperating with law enforcement in their investigation into this tragedy. They respect the investigative process being conducted by the Dayton Police Department and the FBI and will not comment further on this investigation.
The other weekend shooting in El Paso, Texas, is being treated as a case of domestic terrorism by authorities. The El Paso attack, which left 22 people dead, has renewed debate over how to combat domestic terrorism in the United States. Following the two mass shootings over the weekend, members of Congress are speaking up on solutions to gun violence. AP's Shelley Adler reports.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke outside a New York Walmart with GOP Congressman Peter King. Schumer continues to push for the Senate to take up the House gun bill.
The Walmart was in El Paso, but it really could be anywhere in America, even here, as long as easy access to weapons of war remain the unaddressed crisis.
And in Pennsylvania, GOP Senator Pat Toomey says he's spoken with the president.
I later yesterday spoke with Senator Manchin, who is still fully on board with me on our background check legislation. I spoke with Mitch McConnell, and we had a very constructive conversation.
Shelley Adler, Washington.
American author Toni Morrison, the first black woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, has passed away at age 88. AP's Margie Zaraletta has more.
Toni Morrison had been working for Random House and was almost 40 when she published her first novel, The Bluest Eye. She went on to publish such novels as Song of Solomon and Beloved, which won her the Pulitzer Prize in 1988. She won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1993, the first black woman to win. She later taught at Princeton. Morrison told the Associated Press in 2012, the 21st century is not a very nice place and she needed writing to stay steady emotionally. She had said her work highlighted the unfree at the heart of the democratic experiment. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
A new report by the U.S. Defense Department says its plans for a partial withdrawal from Syria may give the Islamic State terror group new life. The report says the reduction of U.S. forces has decreased the support available for Syrian partner forces when they need more training to handle the resurgence of Islamic State militants. Coalition officials say they fear the drawdown could influence U.S.-backed forces to turn away from Washington and seek out alternate partnerships. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawians hold night vigil and vow more protests to force the resignation of the Elections Commission chair.
I am at the vigil outside the Malawi Parliament. That's where citizens in Southern have gathered with a continued demand for Jane Ansah, the chairperson, to resign for messing up with Malawi elections.
Timothy Ntambo is the chair of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition in Malawi. Sierra Leoneans make changes to their country's emergency order on rape. Visitors flock to Ghana to mark the 400th anniversary of slavery, and an analyst sees challenges ahead, even as Sudan's military and protesters sign a power-sharing deal.
I think the prospects remain very tenuous. While there has been some effort made to put together a division of responsibilities, there's still a lot of questions.
Joseph Siegel is director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, and a South Sudanese basketball star encourages young people to take up careers in sports. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawians held a vigil last night outside the Parliament building and vowed more protests to force the resignation of Election Commission Chair Jane Ansah. The protesters accused Justice Ansah of presiding over what they say was a fraudulent May 21st general elections. Tens of thousands marched on Tuesday in the major cities of the country. The protest in the capital, Lilongwe, was marred by violence. Malawi's immediate past Vice President Solos Chilima said the mass protests will continue. Timothy Ntambo, chair of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, says Tuesday's large turnout is a signal to President Peter Mutharika that Malawians demand swift electoral reforms.
I am at the vigil outside the Malawi Parliament. That's where citizens in Southern have gathered with a continued demand for Jane Ansah, the chairperson, to resign for messing up with Malawi's elections.
What can you tell us about Tuesday's protest? What happened?
The protests were actually the first in the history of Malawi. I've never seen such a protest in Africa. We had millions of Malawians across the three cities of Malawi. This is a signal that Malawians are sending to the government of Professor Mutharika, that Malawians are actually tired and they want to demand change and electoral accountability. And if you look at the people in the streets, the people were very, very furious. The police tried to provoke people, tried to tear gas people, tried to block people, tried to stop people. But our people stood up and said enough. Actually, this government is actually stopping people from exercising their rights, which is unconstitutional.
Timothy, the Attorney General had gone to court to ask for a stay on the protest. Any news yet from the Supreme Court?
The Malawi judiciary, through Justice Kenyatta, demonstrated to this world that democracy has won and that the will of the people should never be manipulated and that the constitution of the land should be respected. So we're very proud of the judiciary. We are proud of the Malawi Defense Force because police were actually fighting Malawians.
The protesters engaged in violence because one account said protesters broke into a bank.
No, actually protesters did not get into violence. What happened is that when protesters were gathering, they were very peaceful, there was nothing. But the police came there and they started tear-gassing protesters. Yet the police knew that there is an order from the court that they should allow citizens to exercise their rights. We have an intel that the police had a meeting yesterday, and they were encouraging people, the police officers, to even use light firearms on the demonstrators. Their plan was to disperse demonstrators without any reason. So it was a deliberate provocation to the demonstrators. And that's when chaos started. Demonstrators were all over the city. So it was the police provoking the demonstrators. So whatever happened, it is the product of unprofessionalism of the police. The police can do better than that. We are peaceful people, and we want our government to protect us, not fight us.
Some Malawians have expressed concern that these protests are destabilizing the country. So how long do you think you can sustain the protests?
The concerns are genuine, and as a citizen, I'm very, very concerned. And as a parishion, we have condemned violence, and we have taught the police to ensure that they take care of property and the citizens. Indeed, we cannot continue this way as a country. But we have one problem. Impunity is too high, and our government is not a reasoning government. We are talking about citizens empowered by the law. Section 12 of Malawi Constitution says that mandate to govern is derived from the people of Malawi. So what we are saying is that we don't have any trust in Jen Ansa anymore. We lost the trust in Jen Ansa and in the way they manage elections. So this is an issue which we're saying is non-negotiable. Jen Ansa must go. Immediately, Jen Ansa resigns, all these demonstrations will come to an end.
Timothy, thank you. We are so happy to speak with you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Timothy Mtambo is chair of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition of Malawi. You're speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Sudan's military rulers and the main opposition coalition, the Forces of Freedom and Change, have reached an agreement paving the way for a new transitional government. The deal provides for a joint civilian-military council to oversee the formation of a transitional cabinet and parliament to govern for a little more than 3 years until elections can be held. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shinawi about the prospects of a successful transition to democracy.
I think the prospects remain very tenuous. While there has been some effort made to put together a division of responsibilities and address some of the details of what a power-sharing agreement would look like, there's still a lot of questions. The agreement set up three councils, a sovereign council, a legislative council, and a council of ministers. But division of responsibilities between these different councils is unclear. Moreover, the military will be able to appoint the leader of the sovereign council, which is seen as the main power-wielding authority, at least for the first 21 months. And so it remains unclear just how these actions are going to translate into further democratic change. I think some things we're going to want to look for are just how respected certain democratic rights that were spelled out in the agreement are being upheld on the ground. You know, rights of assembly, rights of expression, freedom of press, the continued restoration of internet access, those types of things I think will be some signals to whether there is some continuing commitment to the transition.
With such a long transitional period, the momentum of street protesting could fade out. Is there any threat of a counter-revolution in Sudan given the power of the military?
I think it's very real that there can be counter-revolution. In fact, it's not apparent to me that the revolution has fully come to pass. You know, the military has held the key levers of power all along, and they continue to do so. And it isn't apparent to me that they have resigned themselves, that they are going to have to genuinely share power. All along in these negotiations, there's been a sense that they are at least verbally agreeing to some sort of power sharing. But in practice, that hasn't yet come to pass. In the end, they always have insisted that they hold the supreme position of whatever transitional arrangement has been under discussion. And so it isn't clear that the military, who has effectively been ruling Sudan for the past 30 years, has accepted the need to share power and to ultimately transition power to a civilian.
Joseph Siegel is Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shinawi. Today is Wednesday, August 7th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The national emergency order against rape in Sierra Leone has been rescinded, but this does not mean the problem is solved. Politicians, lawyers, and advocates are busy writing a bill that would potentially change sentencing laws to encourage more rape victims to come forward and report. Fatmata Asori, president of the Lawyers Association in Sierra Leone, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the proposed changes.
So there is a bill. The bill is currently before Parliament. It had been gazetted as of May 2019 and had a table before Parliament in June. So we started the lobbying and advocacy work with the parliamentarians because we felt the bill was not adequate. We felt it would not address the needs and concerns of the people, especially with the numbers. We felt it would not serve as a deterrent, prevent offenders, and we thought it was very limited in scope. So we started lobbying and advocating for Parliament to look at possibly amending the bill before passing it into law.
As of now, what is the status of the national debate, as you will, over the high numbers of rape cases?
The numbers are still high, and they are higher, they're getting higher than last year. But one of the things is that because people are more comfortable and more prepared to report these cases, they feel that the system would support them. So they're coming forward. Lots of people are coming forward to report. So the culture of silence somehow is broken. The issue, though, is limitation insofar as access to services. The medical services, the access to the police, access to the judiciary, and all the rest of it. But so far, more people are reporting, more cases are being prosecuted, and we've gotten a higher number of convictions as opposed to last year. But what we're looking for is a situation where there would be sociocultural change, norms, and values, and some of our cultural practices also changed, and we believe that would help. We bring in the numbers. But the law is a good thing. It's a good step to have a law with a stiffer and harsher sentence, you know, but we need to also work on changing mindsets.
The law has changed in regards to punishment, or the law has not changed in regards to punishment?
We're in the process of changing it.
And what is the proposed change when it comes to punishment for convicted rapists?
The maximum sentence would be life imprisonment. When the bill was the bill that was tabled in Parliament before the lobbying started, only sentencing available was an either or situation for rape, a minimum of 15 years or a maximum of life imprisonment. And for sexual penetration, it relates to having an intercourse with a child. The sentence was life. The advocates and activists were of the view that the having the harshest sentencing is not the best option insofar as deterring people from becoming offenders. We believe at the end it will be counterproductive because most people would hesitate about coming forward to make reports, or we would have a situation where the victims would probably be killed in the process.
Fatmata Asori is president of the Lawyers Association in Sierra Leone. She spoke to Ricky Stryak from Virginia, USA. 2019 marks the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans to be brought to what is now the United States, arriving in the English colony of Virginia in Ghana. The anniversary has been dubbed the Year of Return, and the country is welcoming the African diaspora with expedited visas and numerous events to discover their roots, even if they do not know their lineage is Ghanaian. Elsha Saraya went to Accra to speak with some of the people bridging the gap between the continents.
I don't specifically know exactly where I would have been from in Africa. I've always assumed that I'm West African.
The biannual PanaFest in Ghana celebrates the idea of Pan-Africanism. But this year, the festival takes on a new meaning as Ghana welcomes members of the African diaspora, many of whom don't know where their ancestors came from before being enslaved, to discover their roots.
For me, it's a trip of a lifetime. I've always fixated on Ghana as a place that I wanted to visit for a long time.
It's amazing to begin to reconnect with family, if you will, and seeing people leave from all over the world.
His Excellency, the President of the Republic of Ghana, Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo, declared 2019 as the year of return for all African Americans and Africans in the diaspora.
When I look at Pan-Africanism, I look at it from the context of unity.
Gail Nikoi, who moved to Ghana from the U.S., heads Ghana's African American Association.
We are all part of the black race. We are all Africans, right? Whether you're an African in America, whether you're an African in Brazil, whether you're African in the Caribbean, if you have a high level of melanin in your skin, you are from Africa.
Nikoi has been working with Ghanaians and other Americans living in Ghana to organize a year of events commemorating African unity on the continent and among the diaspora. Many of the attendees say they were pleasantly surprised by how Accra has shattered their stereotypes of the African continent.
A lot of the somers, a lot of the concept perceptions, even the African Americans, black folks in America think about Africa, right? So that it's all Sudan, it's all jungle, and which is not the case.
In addition to events in Ghana's capital, a big part of the year of return involves traveling to Cape Coast to see the notorious castle used in the transatlantic slave trade. Now a museum showcasing the plight of enslaved Africans before they were taken from the continent forever.
When they come to this place, it's like a pilgrimage, because to many of them, they can only come here once in a lifetime. So when they come here, this place is very important to them, very emotional.
The sense of pilgrimage is felt by many visitors.
It's just really amazing to see, you know, this happening at this point in history. And, I mean, for me, it's just, it's the full circle of things coming to where they belong. I mean, and I feel really a strong sense of belonging here.
Isha Sarai, VOA News, Accra.
Some bold African entrepreneurs are trying to rebuild the clothing industry in Kenya, hoping to reach local and foreign markets, as well as create jobs and industrial expertise. They must overcome tough competition from used clothing, resales, and cheap clothing imports from China. But as Mohammed Yusuf reports, they are getting infrastructure investments and hope to get a boost from a recent free trade agreement coupled with local pride.
Many merchants in Nairobi's bustling toy market are busy selling second-hand clothes. Kenya alone imports 100,000 tons of second-hand clothes every year. That's why similar markets are found in many African countries, and that's why smart, frugal customers like Emily Mugure shop here.
I'm actually just looking for a few items I can add to my closet for work, and I have an event I want to go for, so I'm looking for something unique. Even when you find jackets, the quality is so much better here, and the price is good.
Kenyan businesses hope to get customers like Emily Magure to buy locally made clothing as a step toward reviving the textile industry. Demand from a stronger textile industry helps cotton farmers and helps other businesses expand and develop. Africa's clothing and footwear market is worth $31 billion, and globally, the sector is expected to double in the next decade, generating $5 trillion each year. One effort to get a bigger share of that market for Africans is the African Continental Free Trade Area, which went into force in May. The free trade deal is designed to boost economic growth on the continent by cutting tariffs between member states. Lower cost of trade means more trade, which boosts demand, sales and jobs. Betting on growth, Kenya revived and equipped its biggest textile factory, Rivertex, in June, hoping to create 9,000 jobs at the government-owned facility. Managing Director Thomas Kipkurgut tells VOA his company is getting orders from other African countries.
We have been approached by Namibia government
to make camouflage fabric, and also Uganda, Rwanda, and other countries. So we want to showcase that we can actually make most of the imported.
Chip Kurgat says new equipment makes the factory more efficient and makes its prices more competitive with imports. Speaking to Reuters news agency this week, the president of the African Development Bank, Ikinwumi Adesina, said the continent's industries must improve if they are to grab a share of the growing fashion and textile market.
Africa cannot be a market where others simply import and put stuff in. Africa has to have its own industrial capacity to be able to take advantage of a $3.3 trillion market with the Africa Continental Free Trade Area.
Africa launched its most recent free trade effort in May, and boosting textile industry is one step toward connecting 1.3 billion people across 54 nations. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
South Sudanese basketball star Luol Deng is encouraging young men and women to take careers in sports. Deng, who concluded a five-day visit to South Sudan yesterday, Tuesday, says he believes sports can avail opportunities that could change lives in South Sudan. Winnie Shirino reports from Juba.
The NBA basketball star says he is in Juba to supervise the activities of Luol Deng Foundation. He says he constructed the Manut Ball basketball court in Juba 4 years ago to pay tribute to the former NBA star, late Manut Ball, so that his legacy is remembered by generations of South Sudanese. Deng says his foundation is coaching more upcoming basketball players in South Sudan.
We have a program now that's growing and is getting bigger. We are very proud of it. We know there's a lot of more work. The vision is to make it bigger. I don't know when, but we are hoping to hopefully create an academy. But it's something that we see the success that the kids are having from it. And it's something that is beautiful to share with everyone.
Deng says his foundation has built basketball courts in Awil State, Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, and Wau. He says his foundation has been sending 10 South Sudanese doctors every year abroad for additional training in surgery. He says basketball can also help many South Sudanese develop a career.
We believe that this is a tool that we can use not just for basketball, but it's a way of getting scholarships and going to high schools and getting a better education. And it's also a tool to take kids off the streets, but also occupy them with teamwork, teach them, you know, how to work together, how to communicate.
15-year-old Malong Malual is among the beneficiaries of the Luol Deng Foundation. Malual says the foundation brought him from Rumbek to Juba 2 years ago, and he has completed his senior secondary school.
Luol Deng Foundation is the one who brought me from the village when I was. I do play in village by then. So they went and they see how I play good, and when they brought me to the city and they sponsored me, and they were taking my recommendation.
16-year-old Jeldru Ring, another basketball player, says the Luol Deng Foundation has helped him learn other skills.
It kind of made me a better person, like kind of improved my leadership skills. Like, you know, sometimes I'm the captain, I be the captain of a team, and, you know, got to lead people. My communication skills have improved, you know, talking to my teammates. I got to know a lot of people. Like, I have now, like, a wide range of friends right now.
18-year-old Fiona Richard says she learned to play basketball while in primary school. She says she was lucky to travel up to Texas in the U.S. for trainings and received international scholarships.
I played when I joined senior one. I studied senior one, then senior two, I got a bursary like scholarship for also games. I went to the team to Kenya. I was there for 1 year. I got another bursary also in another school in Uganda. By then it was 2017. I played in Uganda 2018. We went like secondary school. We call it East Africa Games over. So we went, it was in Rwanda, 2018. So we went there, we played, and we won the trophy for the school.
Deng says his foundation will increase the number of women in its programs and create a platform that connects and unifies all South Sudanese in the diaspora. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Malawians held a vigil last night outside the parliament building and vowed more protests to force the resignation of Election Commission Chair Jean Ansah. The protesters accused Justice Ansah of presiding over a fraudulent election. That's it for this Wednesday, August 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Claudie and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the